Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about... In this podcast, I'm going to try and tell the story of how an ordinary doctor was the right doctor at the right time and basically changed or saved my life. Have a life of trust. So if you can imagine, I was going down one track, and without me understanding where I was going and stuff like that, expertly understanding the process, I got onto another track, which was really good. And obviously I can't go into sort of details. One major reason is that people really aren't all that interested in your absolute details. The other one is that this is a life story, so this person is treating other people. So you don't want to actually muck up the story by actually saying too much of all the names and who's and has. So, of course, the way to actually do it, there's sort of the two reasons, but there's two reasons to actually go for an allegory. One is that when we think of a topic and a subject, and we've got our own doctors and stuff like that, we've got our own preconceptions. And if you go with an allegory, a story similar to it, or a fable similar to it, you can actually not bring in your interpretations. It's a sort of fresh thing, and you can actually describe and talk about it. The other aspect is that when you actually really try and take things apart, you actually go through the process and you wind up with raw ideas, and they can sort of stick to the original system, but they don't actually integrate fully well, because there's sort of, you have to sort of explain linkages as you carve out an idea and hold it aside. Now, allegories and stories like that, I've told a few fantasy stories and stuff like that, or I've addressed someone's particular question, and as far as a podcast goes, very few people in the technical audience click on it. And so I sort of accept that. I should say that I'm not sort of podcasting for, I suppose, audio quality, speed and stuff like that, or for to service a particular audience. It's more as a process of speaking to improve my part of the rehab. Part of the story is improving it and practicing all the time, and hopefully I am doing that. But whether I am or not, I've still got to keep on pushing out there. And there's, besides the delivering, there's the actual structuring of the ideas to say, well, this is the idea, and you don't dwell on it, I think, enough, you have it to structure. Now, often you, in a work environment or a customer, you have a delivery zone for something. That is, you have your ideas, you're going to select a few of them in a particular way and deliver them at a board meeting. And then we all know that ideas don't go fully across all the details, but you get the flavour of it, and there's that feeling, and you can actually move forward. Now, of course, if you're not doing that, the ideas sort of stick with you, and they mould, and they molt, and there's too many to get through, and they build up, and it's sort of like a messy, messy desk. So there is this skill that you have in the workplace and in the community of actually putting together ideas, storing them, harvesting them, polishing them, presenting them not completely, and they don't quite go the way you want to, and you go through it. Now, obviously, a podcast is second best to that. So that's the actual cognitive rehab, sort of the processing, presenting and communicating, and then the processing, actually physically processing the basic ideas. So that's the story. So summarising so far, we've got the need for an allegory to keep anonymity, but also to get to the raw ideas. We've got the process of podcasting going ahead, and you've got the plus side is it's helpful for me, and it's not necessarily helpful for the audience. A lot of people switch off. So let's look at the fundamental aspect of it in terms of have a sequence of events, and some of the events you can put down on one side. Yeah, I can see how that has happened. That is, I've diet, genetics and stuff like that have led to this situation coming across. I can see how other factors have come across. So in my case, I had a heart condition, a bypass, and a valve put in, and a major reset and hurdles associated with it. But there's things that you can explain. And then there's other things which you say, oh, that explanation is true, but really there's other things behind it. So it's the truth is to see why relatives in generations before haven't had it, because the technology hasn't been there. Why, if I was, say, in regional Australia, I wouldn't have it. So I'm close to the centre and there's enough people to go around and fix it up. Or if I was in another country. So there's a whole way that Australia, we're not conducting a war. We're not building industries. So we've decided that we're going to have a HDI, a Human Development Index. Our HDI is very high. And so we are honing our skills. And so this is one of the things I've thought of in terms of, you know, why was I particularly fixed up? Because it cost a lot of money, and in days gone by, we would be actually just cheaper to mourn people and let them go and clean the slate, because, you know, I'm taking up space for people in the process. So it's not necessarily a great thing to save people, because they're not as productive and stuff like that. But then you look across and there's someone who's got diabetes and heart condition, or they've smoked and had heart conditions, or they've driven a truck and been very aggressive all their life and complaining all their life, and they're the sort of people who haven't looked after themselves. They've got a heart condition and they're just up there with you being treated at the same time. There's other people, sort of beautiful old veterans and beautiful old people being treated greatly, but you've got this whole spectrum, and we're treating a lot of them. And you sort of ask, how is that so? And you realise that you have an answer, but you don't fully have the answer. I don't think people fully understand why there's all this. So there's masses of technology. There's MRI machines. There's CAT scanners. There's hospitals. There's people. And they're all, I don't understand that. They seem to be a bit stressed. You know, they're doing their job. There's feeling. Sometimes there's a bit of happiness. In general, there's a bit of laid back joy. Well, you pick up there, but then there's other people who feel a bit stressed. Sort of remember there was one time where they injected contrast into a muscle. When I was getting a CAT scan, takes what, long time preparation, and then about 2 seconds. It's taken. However, when they injected, there was a whole lot of problem, because my heart was running down, my veins were shit and stuff like that. And it went in, and the nurse was really stressed, and she squeezed my arm to get the contrast juice out. And of course, it did went out, and it spurted all over her. And she was stressed, and she thought I might complain. There's just so much going on, so much building technology. You just wouldn't complain, but you've got all those processes coming on. So you question these things, and you realise there's some things where you have answers, some things where you don't. And one of the questions I have is that obviously I had been to a number, not many doctors over the years, probably 10 years without seeing a doctor or something like that. Probably 5 years, and some doctors were right on, other doctors were sort of dismissive and actually fed into your male view of nothing to see here, move on, you know something's wrong, but they've said no, so you just got to try it and go on. Then, so you've got that type of stuff, and then you have other doctors, the doctor in question, who can actually see the situation, see the dynamics around the situation, see all through, understand the personality type, the potential problem, and match that together. So the personality type, the potential problem, the surrounding stuff, and actually just open the door and steer it in the correct direction. You don't know what you're doing. You're plodding along. You look back and you say, oh, this person's had enormous understanding. And it's just an act of faith that I've actually gone to that particular person. I think the actual doctor who was, I'm supposed to see, wasn't available that day, so I saw this other doctor for the first time. So within that day or the next day, I went for a heart stress test, and the conditions around were, oh, there's nothing wrong. So it took about 6 months before for it to click and go through. But the overall support was amazing. So you question what's going on. And to get your answers, it's very hard to get the answer if you say, oh, well, it's because of this person's education, or that person dresses this way or sits that way in their chair. It's to actually pull back, and you have the allegory. So I'm going to have the allegory story. So I've given you the bit of the background in terms of podcasting, allegories in general. People don't like it, why I'm doing it, and what the allegory is going to try and do, because it's really hard unless you get an allegory absolutely spot on, and particularly with the Aesop's fables. They've been discussed before many times, and so when you first hear it, a small child hears it, they hear about, I think, the fox and the grapes, or the goose, or whatever it's in the fables, and that they've heard about it. It takes a period of time, so people get it instantly, but they forget that they've had heaps of cultural preparation. So the idea of the hare and the tortoise, or something like that has been said many, many times and instructed. So a fable is very difficult to go through. And so this is why I've given a bit of the at the end, you say, oh, well, it's this. Okay, so what I'm going to do is actually talk about a landscape. A beautiful, the protagonists in this, the ordinary people, are wildebeests. Now, I know wildebeests go in herds, but there's, if you can imagine, a beautiful big African savanna. And the idea is that in this savanna, which to me is knowledge and experience, and it's so vast, but eventually it leads into the ocean going forward. And you've got this beautiful savanna, you look up at the top of it, and you can see tiny wildebeests, and they like to migrate in a herd, but they cover different areas, and they sometimes they come up to a stream, and there's crocodiles in it. There's sometimes there's adventures, but they're together, and together they're exploring this huge space, the wilderness, the wildebeest in the wilderness. However, there is this plateau, sort of Lion King type of plateau, to this hill with an outcropping stuff. And bit by bit, part of the story of the wildebeest is going past. They say, oh, look, you've got to climb up that hill. And eventually what happens is that some of the wildebeests peel off and they start climbing up that hill. To me, that's a bit of the education system, where you start to go up a social system and you lose touch with the broader experience, and you go up. And you can't turn back to go down, because there's other wildebeests coming up, and it's all geared, it's sort of one-way traffic up the top of this major thing. And up the top, there isn't actually quite a lot of feed, and wildebeests can't see very far. Very few wildebeests can see very far, so it's no sense of a cliff or an edge and stuff like that. There's not necessarily a lot of food, there's a lot of bit of stress and tension, and there's a bit of bickering and pushing. And once a wildebeest begins to start pushing a slightly weaker one over the edge, they can't stop, because it's just the way they are. They actually get involved and push, because they've pushed already, that's what they do, because they might be pushed back themselves, or if they're not pushing, they might be pushed, or there's certain reasons. And the sort of strange feeling that they know that they could be going in these beautiful straight lines across this savanna of knowledge, but they're on this cliff up the top. Not a lot of food, and a lot of wildebeests, generation after generation, coming up the top. And little by little, some wildebeests get upset, and they go backwards, and they they fall off the cliff down and they smash into rocks and stuff like that. And then there's this terror of being pushed off the cliff. Some wildebeests say, "Oh, it's time, cliff time. I'll just leave it to me. I'll just jump off myself. I'll just fall off the cliff." And they fall down, and seeing it fall down makes it all the more important to be up the top. Because if you're up the top and you know where you are, you're not going to fall down. It's a pretty logical story, but that's the way it is that we're dealing with this. And it sort of came for my time to do it. I was talking about savannas to them, these large expanses. I was talking about the ocean. And these wildebeests have never been to the ocean, never been to savannah, never actually walked in a long straight line. So when I talk about straight line walking, is that if you go back in your history and you have made the same value decisions, kept by friends unwaveringly, and in 1 year, 10, 20, 30 years ago, you've kept the same friends and you've never wavered, and you have kept the same value, not stupid values, but the integrity of knowledge, the basic integrity of their concept. You can say the direction you're going and you can draw a dotted line, you can extrapolate where you're going. You're a wildebeest of the savannah. Now, if you haven't done that a lot and you've got a small, you obviously can't do that in a small little cliff top area. You have to mull around as a wildebeest, so you can't do it. And if a wildebeest starts talking about this, there's really no understanding what are they talking about, because if you walked in a straight line for any distance, you'd fall off, and then it's getting a bit crowded, and the way that you create space for yourself up the top of this plateau is push people off. And so it was my time to fall, and when I fell down this cliff as a wildebeest, I hit a tree and it broke my fall. Sort of held me for a short while and pushed me off onto slightly softer soil away from the cutting jagged rocks. It didn't stop the fall, it just broke the fall a little bit. And when I got up, I had sort of a few broken bones, a bit dizzy, and mentality of falling and the environment here. And then little by little, the sort of smell of the savannah came into my wildebeest nostrils, and I could say, that's where I'm going to go. And little by little, there was a few other broken wildebeests down there, and they're a bit dazed, and they were talking about the cliff, and I began to actually gather them together and actually say, well, look, this is about the Great Plains, and this is about reaching there and going far, and with support we will take little walks. It's sort of the natural leadership to go across. And bit by bit you talk to them, and they too have had off the cliff experiences and feeling about should I get my hooves ready and start back up again. You could, but it's going to end the same way, isn't it? Ultimately, once they've got in there, especially if you say, look, they're pushing you off the cliff, you're going to be the one pushed off the cliff as quickly as possible. No, there's a bigger thing, and it's the journey hasn't begun, because there's a lot of thinking to go across, and as a wildebeest with a slightly, bent hooves and stuff like that, you can't go far. You can just go for little directions, and there's lots of feed there anyway, and directions to go. But you look over your shoulder, and you look up, and you say, that tree, for me in particular, was very important that it was there. And in your sense of that smell of savannah direction, I go, you look up the cliff and you say, why was that particular tree there? What goes about it? And what is it about that particular tree? And one of the things is that you can't, it's sort of like the solution isn't a written solution. So there's sort of two ways you can bring world peace. You can create a UN force and have the little UN blue hats go around with the little APCs popping around the place, stuff like that. Because you have a solution of peace and you're going forward. But another alternative to it is to be sort of a Gandhi or someone who studies peace, thinks about peace, and somehow the solution actually gets into their actions and stuff like that. So this is here where I'm realizing, I'm beginning to break other people's falls and just slow them down a bit and put them into a slightly softer place, landing place. I can't beat gravity. I can't beat the fact that they've fallen from such a great height, but I can at least break their fall a little bit. And it's not that it's a solution. I'm saying that this is a recipe to go out and try it. It's basically from thinking enough, this actual solution permeates in a deeper way through you. So still nonetheless, let's talk about some parameters of that tree. There's not many trees in the cliff, for sure. So it requires a sort of a root hold for it to go there. And the particular type of tree which sits on cliffs are not the mighty oaks. Because the mighty oaks are so big that they'll grow and they have the center of gravity and they'll be just pushed out. They'll just fall out. A storm will come along. A mighty oak is to be on top of a cliff or at the bottom of a savanna. That's where it spreads its beautiful, you know, branches and I think oaks have chestnuts, I suppose, and stuff like that. And there's a sense that it will have animals going around it and going up. So they're not necessarily your mighty oak that goes across there. In fact, sometimes they're quite scraggly trees. And the main thing is to get a foothold in. And they're ones which can take a bit of a storm going through, I suppose the wind's going through it, and their nutrients and the rain, they get a lot of nutrients and rain because a tree in a field has to lay down deep roots and it has to actually push the other trees around it. Up here, there's not a lot of competition for it. The rain hits the side of the cliff and trickles down the cliff. So it gets quite a lot of water. The nutrients there is from a different type of source. So in general, if you're a big tree, you have a lot of birds sitting in it. And the birds bicker and fight, and you pay attention to it, and that crap, and their crap supports your roots. However, if you're a tree growing at an angle from a cliff, and you're out there, and in a sense, the bird poo falls straight down. You don't have as much bird poo on you, and it's fallen straight out of your branches, but it's not there. And so there's a bit of things. It's also that one of the things is that if you have a branch that breaks, it falls and goes straight away. It's gone from there. So it's those sorts of things here. It's how it grows on the cliff. So there's not a lot of them. That's one of the things, I suppose, allegory-wise. There's not a lot of these people or trees about the place. And they're growing in a particular way in which the big oak trees can't understand it. It's a sideways cliff-growing tree. But there is a different thing going on. Some oak trees have to grow tall because there's a whole lot of trees around them also growing tall. They have to go really tall to go across the top of the forest canopy and look across. So once they're tall, they can't see the ground beneath them because they are so tall, and they can't necessarily see the roots, and they can't see the ground next to the trees right next to them. They can see right over on the distance and they can see sorts of things. The tree on the side of the cliff, on the other hand, can actually, because it's out there, it's got at least a view of one part of the canopy, one part of the savannah. And it can see, it's got an unimpeded view, and it can see, and it can feel the winds, and it can't necessarily, because it's high up, it can't necessarily smell the savannah, but it can see the wildebeest and stuff like that, and it can have a little bit of a sense of what's going on in the wildebeest and stuff like that. And it's poor little thing, it has to take the occasional wildebeest falling down on it, bouncing it off to the side. But that sort of thing sort of loosens the soil a bit, it pulls the soil out a bit more, but it allows other nutrients to go in and the roots to take hold a bit more, so it can hang onto a cliff. And it's not necessarily an appreciated tree. It's not a tree that the axemen can say, that is a fantastic tree. There is actually a Chinese proverb saying that it's far better to be a gnarly tree, in a paddock that no one wants to cut down, because you're going to survive. But indeed, it's going to be a little bit harder. As people can say, that is really spoiling my cliff. I want my cliff for my wildebeest just to jump up, pay me money and jump off, and next one come along. That tree is getting in the way, but it's really a bit hard to axe it down. Now, I suppose what I want to finish off is the story is getting back. So that's the tree, and it's not fully understood, but some of the attributes of that tree, you can't speak to it. A wildebeest cannot speak to a tree halfway up a cliff. Impossible. It's done. It can't actually get any tree genetics in it and stuff like that. But it can think about what that tree is doing. It can't actually produce a novel about it. The novel is actually in the way that the wildebeest goes. And so that little bit of tree goes along, and the journey to take the other wounded wildebeest a bit hobbly along. Doesn't really matter, we're all slightly battered and all that type of stuff, and take them on a big journey. And you take them, I suppose, my big journey. Where's the big journey? I think the big journey is across the savannah, avoid the crocodile-infested waters, ignore where there's huge numbers of wildebeests going in, pick a spot when the wildebeests aren't trapped and across. Basically, the tone depth to the other wildebeest on top of the cliff, showing you, bloody hell, get back up here, again. Just not listen to that. Broken wildebeest to the seaside, the edge of the savannah, the sea, and build a boat and sail to another land. And that's sort of where it is. It's just the nostrils having a bit of that scent of the dry, harsh ones where there's going to be feed, the rain and stuff like that. Get a bit of the sea salt in your wildebeest nostrils and take it forward. So that's my allegory that I'm trying to put across. And the actual cognitive thing to me is to actually understand the levels of allegory and sort of understand the medium. So if I was to write that up in an essay, no one would read it, was one thing. And the type of people who can understand the complexity can't understand allegory. So you've got a series of problems through the written form, and the written form requires a series of engineering things to go across. And so if you have the idea, you hold it in your head for the written form sufficiently long that it ruins it. But the podcast, something which allows you to actually speak about it, get it together, and push it out. So I suppose there's sort of two take-home points. If you see any feature, is to sort of understand whether it would be a big tall oak tree or a tree with roots into the water and the stream goes around, or a tree halfway up to actually, you're not going to chop it down. You're not the sort of wildebeest which is crapping onto other wildebeests to do things. You're just leading by example, and to try and understand it. But your knowledge is not, you know, bullet points in a PowerPoint. It's got features A, B, and C, and here's an example. If it doesn't have C but D, this process comes, and therefore logically, and and pay me money again. No, particularly because no one's particularly listening to you. All you can actually do is actually imitate it a little bit, or use the contemplation or the understanding of what's happened, and actually saying, I can actually use a little bit of that, not directly, but, you know, in thinking when I'm dealing with my own wounded wildebeests and we're taking our next step to the shore. I don't know whether the wildebeests want to go in the water, but that's where they're going. That's where the new horizon is. The new, it's not for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.